Michelle Sullivan, and you're listening to Swan Feather Radio, a podcast series about creatives, innovators, entrepreneurs, and thought leaders sharing their experiences in our cultural economy. For each episode, we paired two wonderful people for a conversation that we believe is important to share. We hear them discuss their work and creative process, what influences have guided their decisions, and those with whom they've shared their journey. Swan Feather Radio is presented in association with our friends at WeTransfer and Warner Music Group.
I'm Bill Hayes. I'm a writer and photographer based in New York, the author of Insomniac City.
I'm James Stephen. I'm a transplant to New York from London, and I work at Warner Music Group.
This is the opening of Insomniac City. I moved to New York 8 years ago and felt at once at home. In the haggard buildings and bloodshot skies, in trains that never stopped running, like my racing mind at night, I recognized my insomniac self. If New York were a patient, you would be diagnosed with agrypnea excitata, a rare genetic condition characterized by insomnia, nervous energy, constant twitching, and dream enactment. An apt description of a city that never sleeps, a place where one comes to reinvent himself. I had brought very little with me from San Francisco, my home for 25 years, in part because I wished to leave behind any reminders of the life I'd had there, but also for more practical reasons. My new apartment was a virtual treehouse, a tiny top floor walk-up at eye level with the ailanthus boughs. There was not room for more than a desk, a chair, a mattress, nor a need. You see, the place came furnished with spectacular views of Manhattan. What I didn't know when I rented the place was that the French restaurant located straight below my apartment had outdoor seating till 2 a.m. Lying awake in bed, I could literally hear glasses clinking and toast being made six stories down. This was irritating at first, but it wasn't long before I discovered a phenomenon heretofore unknown to me. Laughter rises. Hearing happy, laughing people is no cure for insomnia, but has an ameliorative effect on brokenheartedness. Sometimes I'd sit in the kitchen in the dark and gaze out at the Empire State and Chrysler buildings. Such a beautiful pair, so impeccably dressed, he in his boxy suit, every night a different hue, and she, an arm's length away, in her filigreed skirt, the color of the moon. I regarded them as an old married couple, calmly, unblinkingly keeping watch over one of their newest sons. And I returned the favor. I would be there the moment the Empire State turned off its lights for the night, as if to get a little shut-eye before sunrise.
You say in the book, it's hardest to write when there's so much to say. And I kind of thought I would start by asking you, when did you know you were going to write this book? And which came first, Oliver Sacks or New York?
New York definitely came first. This book was not supposed to be written. I actually had a contract to write a book, a different book, on the history of exercise,
right,
called Sweat, which was a little bit more like my earlier books. I'd written three other books. And as part of my contract, my agent, being a really good agent, got a second book added to the deal. So it was a two-book deal. But the second book was just a very vaguely described New York book, based upon the fact that I had written by that point a couple of short pieces published in the New York Times about moving to New York at age 48, life in New York, discovering it in middle age. But the book wasn't conceived at all. And I began working on the other book, The History of Exercise. I worked on it for a couple of years. Then my partner, Oliver Sacks, got sick. I put everything aside. Once he got ill and spent the year with him, and that's something I'm sure we'll talk about. After his death, when I came back to writing, the history of exercise was just sort of not in me. And I decided to go back to this New York book, which I had not really conceived, and began thinking of it, and it came together really quickly. But from the outset, I had not thought about writing about Oliver Sacks or my relationship with him. It was just going to be a book about New York. So from the very beginning, that was really what I knew. New York City would be the main character, and it would be a book about my romance with New York. And Insomniac City is that, but it's now a few other things as well.
So as you were writing, Oliver Sacks kind of became one of the characters in the book.
Mm-hmm. I started thinking about this book a few months after his death. He died in August 2015. And began thinking, well, maybe I'll do this New York book. But I didn't know how I would approach writing about our relationship and our life together. In a certain way, Oliver gave me a great gift, because in his autobiography, he'd written about our relationship and about his sexuality. And of course, he wrote about his illness so eloquently in a series of pieces for the New York Times. So I didn't feel like writing about those things and about our relationship would be indiscreet. But at the same time, I didn't know exactly how I would write about it. And then I remembered, really, it sort of hit me. I'd been keeping this journal since I moved to New York City. And a journal started at Oliver's behest. It was less than a month after moving to New York in the spring of 2009. And one day Oliver said to me, "You must keep a journal." And it was kind of more an instruction than a suggestion. And I thought, I guess I must. And actually wrote that phrase down on a scrap of paper, which I still have. And it says, it's 5-9-09, May 9th, 2009. O says I must keep a journal. And so I started writing impressions of my life in New York, scenes, stories, conversations with Oliver. The journal was kept in a really haphazard way, sometimes on scraps of paper, sometimes handwritten in journals, sometimes on a laptop. And in the lead up to working on this book, I put everything together and transcribed notes and put everything into one file. And to my really great surprise, it amounted to about 750 pages.
Wow.
Yeah, I was surprised. I took it to Staples and had it printed out, double-spaced, and put it into a three-ring binder. And really pretty quickly after I started paging through this journal, this 750-page journal, filled with stories and scenes and conversations, I thought, this is a key to this book, that I'll be able to use scenes and snatches of conversation and intertwine them with stories about my life in New York. So that was sort of the key to opening the door. It happened pretty fast, and then this book came together pretty quickly.
The book is very revealing of certain things, but you don't learn much about you as you read the book. What's your workspace like? As a writer, how do you sort of set your life up?
Yeah, you know, other people have said that. You get to know Oliver so well in the book because there's so many scenes with him and others. Hopefully the reader gets a sense of me reflected back through those scenes and those conversations and what kind of person I might be. But I think I found it hard just to write about myself in the same way that I don't take self-portraits with my camera. My life, I'm a pretty solitary person in a lot of ways. I'm, I think, quite self-disciplined with my writing and with my photography. And I'm also, as we talked about, very open to chance and have lived a pretty intuitive life, letting life take me where it will. So there's this kind of combination of being intuitive and self-disciplined, and I would have to say it comes like directly from each of my parents. My dad was a West Point cadet, very strict, disciplinarian, very devout Catholic, pretty tough. And my mom was a much more free-spirited, she was an artist, she was a painter, she had lived in New York City, much more open. And so between the two of them, I think is, you kind of get me. That's the equation.
And you have five sisters?
I have five sisters.
That's unusual.
It is, yeah. I have five sisters, and we're all very close in age. My mom, as many women did of that generation, had a lot of kids in a short period. So she had six kids in 9 years. And
wow.
Yeah. So I'm fifth of six, but we're all now in our 50s or early 60s.
You close?
We are close. We are close. In fact, I just saw them 2 weeks ago. My dad passed away. He was 93, and his death was expected in that he was quite elderly and had been quite ill for some time. I write a little bit about him in Insomniac City. So he did pass away, and I was just back in Seattle to see my sisters and gather, and we talked a lot about our dad and our mom.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Thank you.
When did you decide you were going to be a writer? Like, was that something you were encouraged to do growing up?
I was not discouraged. I was thinking about that today. I think from a fairly young age, like young teenage years, I loved to write. I was, it was something I was good at. I had high school teachers who encouraged me. For me, high school was the most impressionable period. For others, maybe it's college or, you know, the early 20s. High school was just a very important time, and I did have teachers who recognized I had some writing talent, and that's what I spent my time on. And yeah, I dreamed of being a poet. I thought I was going to be a poet, much to my father's, you know, surprise. But as tough as he was and as different as we were, and that became very clear after I came out in the 80s, he still, you know, he didn't discourage me either. I think they knew I had some talent and the drive to do it.
I think one of the reasons that I really loved the book was that, like I said, you know, you sort of described grief in a way that made me feel better, was very life-affirming. It coming to New York for me was a real mix of that kind of positivity and negativity. You know, I'd never actually lived in, other than being a student in Edinburgh, I'd never lived anywhere other than London. Mm-hmm. And so at 35 to come and live in New York, you know, when I kind of gathered all my friends and kind of knew my life, I always sort of say it was like taking my brain out and washing it and then putting it back. Like everything was just suddenly in very vivid color.
Yeah.
But it was also a time when we made the decision to move, my wife and I, and about 3 days later, we were sitting in a doctor's office being told that we would never have kids of our own. And it was a very emotional time. And the thing that I remember my wife saying was, I don't want to give up on New York and kids at the same time. We have to still go. We have to roll the dice. We have to do this. Mm-hmm. We came to New York and it worked out, mm-hmm. but it was a gamble that paid off, you know? Like
that's such a beautiful story. Yeah. That's a beautiful story. I think you're right, too, about family and the families you create. One of the characters in Insomniac City, who I did not expect to become a kind of minor character, recurring character in the book, is Ali.
Yes!
Who I just thought of. But Ali is the manager of a smoke shop down the street.
And just, when
you live in New York, there are bodegas and smoke shops on almost every street or every few streets. And I found so many stories about Ali that I had written down, and I found myself weaving Ali more and more into the book, to the point where, other than Oliver Sacks and Bill Hayes, Ali is probably the third major character in the book. He keeps appearing because he is part of my life.
Yeah,
I stop in there to buy a New Yorker magazine or a Sunday New York Times or a bottle of water, and he happens to be a very wise fellow. He's lived a lot of life, and he's seen a lot, and in his spot at the smoke shop, he sees a lot of life on 8th Avenue. And so the wisdom of Ali is as much a part of this book as that of Oliver Sacks.
Amazing. Another thing that I wrote to Michelle about was the fact that you have Oliver Sacks at the center of the book, and it's this very intimate, passionate thing. Mm-hmm. And then there's the guy that you buy your New Yorker from,
right,
which traditionally is at the other end of the scale, but right, he's someone who you have a very deep relationship with.
I do.
One of my questions was, do you still see him?
Like, I do. I do. And
Has he read the book?
He has read the book, and he's very proud to be in the book. And we have this deal where, of course, I've offered to give him books if he wants to give them to family or friends or customers who ask about it. And at first, he was rather shy about it, but he's gotten much more, welcoming. But the deal is he will only take two at a time. Because I've said to him, like, Ali, I can give you like 6 or 8 books, and then if you want to give them away, no. Just two. Two is enough. So it's always just two, and I'll bring him two, and then maybe 2 or 3 weeks later I'll check in with him, and he'll have given them away because he enjoys giving them to friends or customers. And I say, do you need more? And he'll say, yes, just two. And if I were to bring in three, I'm sure he would say, no, just two. So he's, in a way, there's something beautiful about that modesty. And also I think about how one lives one's life. You know, it's two's enough. I don't need more. I don't need less. Two books is enough. I do love that in this book one gets the brilliance of Oliver Sacks. And he was, without question, brilliant and sort of chronically quotable. So he would say these profound and amazing and sometimes hilarious things. But then one also gets the wisdom, sort of the street wisdom of someone like Ali, who's seen a lot of New York and knows New York and life from a different perspective. And that of an immigrant, by the way.
Swan Feather Radio is supported by WeTransfer. They help us with providing the easiest way to send large files to our creative community. WeTransfer uses its wallpaper background to support a diverse cross-section of talent, and you can learn more at WeTransfer.com.
Actually reminds me that I wanted to ask you about music because you have very good music taste. I liked all the musical references. I think people should read the passages about you and Oliver Sacks going to visit Bjork.
Yeah.
That they're stunning. Mm-hmm. I loved the Joni Mitchell reference. Mm. Can you just talk a little bit about music?
I'm so glad you asked. There is a lot of music in the book because there's a lot of music in my life, and there has been in my life. And we talked a little bit earlier about influences and when did I decide to become a writer, and I didn't say this, but I think music and songwriters played a bigger part in my becoming a writer and the kind of writing I do than any certain author or books. I was in high school, I loved Joni Mitchell. It was the 1970s, so there was a whole period of singer-songwriters who were doing amazing work, and I think that had a big impact on me. And that kind of very personal, or what used to be called confessional poetry or confessional songwriting, I think had a big impact on the kind of work that I do. And when I ride the subway, I'm always listening to music. I love to listen to music on the subway and watch people. And in a certain way, this book was influenced by in its design and in its conception and in its structure by record albums of the 1970s. You'll remember, I'm not sure everyone listening will, but record albums, just as themselves, used to be such beautiful objects, like books we were talking about. Such care given to the graphic design for these formats. I'm not sure what the inches were, but they were sort of these large squares on which you could create, you know, beautiful objects. And often you'd open the album and there would be all the lyrics printed across both sides of the album, the container. I put this book together during 6 weeks in Rome. I had a fellowship at the American Academy in Rome, and they gave me this perfect live-work loft with a bed and a desk and a sink and a bathroom. And the greatest thing about it, it was two stories, and both walls, facing walls, were covered with bulletin board material, like just white bulletin board material. And on the desk was a little tin with pushpins. And as I worked on this book, I would just take a thumbtack and tack a page up onto the bulletin board wall. And I laid out the entire book from page 1 to page 299 on the walls of this studio and wove in the photographs when I could. And I was just constantly seeing it visually, much like those record albums from the 70s. And seeing the white space and wanting this book to have enough white space, as I've said, that it gives the reader a little space to think and dream and imagine. And I think that's how I listen to music, too. And on my iPod, and I do still have an iPod, is everything from Joni Mitchell and Bjork to Bach and Mozart.
Amazing, amazing answer. We actually, we talked a little bit about photography, your influences in photography. We've talked a little bit about musicians that influenced mm-hmm. you. What about writers? You mentioned Joan Didion and mm-hmm. a few others.
I think very influenced by the by essayists like Joan Didion, kind of the new journalism writers of the 60s and 70s. So Didion, Tom Wolfe, Janet Malcolm, definitely Susan Sontag, Sylvia Plath, Joni Mitchell. The essay form was something I loved, but in my early life as a writer, it fit very practically into the life I was leading. For many years, I worked full-time. And when I was living in San Francisco, I worked full-time for nonprofits. And the only time I had to write was before work or on the weekends. So the personal essay, generally of a length of about 1,000 words, maybe 2,000 words, was practically speaking what I could manage. And I would write these 1,000 or 1,500 word essays and send them off in the mail. There wasn't email in those days. And wait week after week to get a response and usually get a rejection in the mail. And one time I sort of hit it big for the first time and got an acceptance from the New York Times Magazine. And an editor there had read one of my essays from a slush pile. And that's really how my publishing career started.
Have you, you know, it's clear that you've studied writing, but have you studied photography? Are there street photographers that you admire, or is it more something that you've just practiced?
I'm pretty much self-taught. I bought my first camera really in 2007 after Steve's death, and I made a trip to London. And just graduated to better and better cameras. I was shooting digitally. I had a very short stint trying to shoot film, but I realized I love shooting digitally. So with each camera, each better camera, I've learned how to use it. There are definitely street photographers I love and whose work I love and who have influenced me. And from an early age, I loved photography. So I've always, throughout my life, sought out photography exhibits, whether Deanne Arbus or Gary Winogrand or Lee Friedlander, Helen Levitt. I love that whole New York school and American school of street photography. So that when it came a time when I finally had a camera in my hand, even if it was a not great point and shoot camera like I was first using, I knew the kind of picture I wanted to take. and it was always portraits. It was always people. And I kind of knew the aesthetic. But one thing important to me from the very beginning was that I would ask permission of the subject. So although it is street photography, and I really almost never know the person, I ask permission, I say, can I take your picture? So there is an immediate trust placed in me by the subject, and I guess trust I put in them for the picture. And when they work, there's a kind of magic that happens in that intimate, immediate encounter that's very spontaneous. Very often, I don't even get their name. But something very intimate happens, and when the photos work, you see that in the picture.
The ones of couples especially, I think. Yeah. You have a book coming out, right?
I do. I have a book coming out in February of next year, which is just my street photography, about 150 photographs. So although it's my fifth book, it's my first book of photography, and I'm really excited about that. The book is called How New York Breaks Your Heart. And in some ways, it's a complement to Insomniac City, kind of the inverse proportion. This is all photographs with a little bit of text, whereas Insomniac City is a memoir with about 40 photographs.
Are there photographs of Oliver in the book?
In the new photography book, there's a single photograph of Oliver Sacks, but like every other photo in the book, it's a street photograph. So it's Oliver on the street.
Because also, I mean, those images you took of him are kind of very memorable. And also the environment that he worked in, the objects on his desk and stuff like that.
In a way, those are almost like portraits of Oliver himself. There's a photo in the book of his, he called it his periodic table. It was a round brass table on which he placed some of the elements he loved and fossils. He loved fossils, the periodic table, and he would rearrange it and rearrange it in different ways. And the photo I took, which is in the book, I took after his death, actually. And in some ways, I mean, it's not his face, but it's like, it's almost like a portrait of him.
It's very intimate.
It's very intimate.
Because it's a workspace and very personal.
Yeah. And most of the photos, or I guess probably all the photos of him in Insomniac City are inside the apartment. And I'm sure you picked up on this, but one thing I really wanted to try to capture in this book was how my life has felt in New York, or to put it another way, how it feels to live in New York City. So there's the life I led with Oliver in the apartment, which was sort of like a cocoon of creativity and music and conversation. I think it's important to say, because it's almost hard to remember, but there was no technology in the apartment. He didn't have a computer, there was no Wi-Fi, he didn't have a cell phone. So there was very little distraction of that kind. And we had a TV, but we didn't watch it very often, partly because he didn't see or hear well. So the scenes with Oliver are pretty much inside the apartment and have that kind of cocoon-like feeling. And then you turn the page, and it's me out on the streets of New York, and meeting people and having encounters and taking photographs. So the book kind of goes back and forth between this interior and exterior.
I wrote down a couple of things about him that I loved the detail of the fact that for whatever reason, late in life he'd never opened champagne, like a champagne bottle, and insisted on wearing swimming goggles, which I just thought was so brilliant.
It was, and so adorable, and so typical of him, in that he'd never tried it, he'd never had a reason to, he'd probably always been afraid to. He was afraid that the cork would blow across the room, like in the movies or something. And also, you know, he had never had a relationship before meeting me. So he'd never had that experience of celebrating New Year's Eve with someone you love and opening a bottle of champagne. But he would only do it, I taught him how to do it, but he would only do it wearing swimming goggles, you know, just in case.
And that the other thing I wrote down was when him saying to you, you create the need you fill, like Jesus or Kierkegaard. Something you just said then, what was it, do you think, about you that made him decide this is the person I'm going to have a relationship with after all these years?
Well, let me answer your question in a slightly different way. I think the book Insomniac City is about reinvention, or about reinventing yourself, reinventing oneself. When I was working on the book, I was conscious of that, that my moving to New York at 48 after losing someone I loved, I was reinventing myself and my life and becoming a photographer and becoming a New Yorker. And it was only after the book was done and probably in galleys and I was looking at it with a little more distance that I realized the book is also about Oliver Sacks's own reinvention and reinventing himself at age 75. Because he had led a life devoted to his practice, his neurology practice, his patients, and his incredible writing. He'd written a dozen books, dozens, if not hundreds, of essays and articles, and had never had a romantic relationship. By the time I met him, he'd accomplished so much that I think he was ready for that. Again, going back to that idea of being open to chance, it was kind of a chance meeting of two souls who were ready for that experience. I certainly didn't move to New York thinking I was going to have another relationship and fall in love, and or with Oliver Sacks. But it happened. And why me? I mean, I guess you could also say why him, but I was very open to him, I think, and we fell in love pretty quickly. He was absolutely adorable and brilliant, and well, I think just reading the book, you can see how one could fall in love with him.
And you,
I think too, we were both very. There were so many things about us that were different. He was British. I'm American from the West Coast. He was Oxford educated. All these other things, but we were both very curious people and very open to human beings, although in different ways. Oliver was very shy, and I'm more open and gregarious probably. So if we went on a walk together and I saw someone whose photo I really wanted to take, it would sort of amaze him that I would have the kind of chutzpah to approach that person and take that person's picture.
The fact that he's so present through this book and the book tour and all of the feedback that you've got, does that make it easier or harder, do you think?
A little of both. Sometimes harder. I did a pretty heavy book tour after this book came out in February. And there were times at the end of the day where I felt like I'd spent the whole day answering questions about Oliver and reminiscing and telling stories, and then be back in my hotel room alone at the end of the day and feel really sad and really miss him. And so the absence felt even greater. But at the same time, I'm the beneficiary of a huge amount of love for him and admiration and also, you know, stories. Like, people tell me stories about Oliver Sacks that I never knew, which allows me in a certain way to get to know him even better. And this is something about grief, about losing someone, and it doesn't have to be a famous person like Oliver Sacks. After a death, there is a way in which you can continue to get to know that person through stories heard from others. This happened with Steve too, where after his death, maybe someone would say, you know, I was so sorry to hear about Steve's death. He used to always come into the bookshop, and he would always hum along to the music. And I remember thinking, like, God, I didn't know that about him. Like, I didn't know he would, like, hum along. And those little details, I think, can really help you get through grief, because you sort of are still getting to know that person, but in a wistful and sort of lovely way.
Thank you. I have two things that I'd just like to end with.
Okay.
First is rapid fire questions about music.
Okay.
So, you know, the classic Rolling Stones or Beatles?
Rolling Stones.
After the Gold Rush or Harvest?
After the Gold Rush.
1968 or 72?
72.
Bowie or Prince?
Bowie. That's hard.
Bluegrass or opera?
Bluegrass.
Folk Joni or Jazzy Joni?
Jazzy Joni.
Bjork's Homogenic or Bjork's Post?
God. Homogenic.
Hail to the Thief or OK Computer?
OK Computer.
Last one, Jay-Z or Kanye?
Oh, Jay-Z.
And then I thought it would be good to end with what you call in the book a quick metaphysical inventory.
Ah, right.
Would you mind?
There's a chapter called The Thank You Man, where I make a trip to Brooklyn to see a friend in her band and have a few adventures along the way. And on the way back, and as I make my way toward the subway, I see the clouds up above. And I write, as I walked back toward the subway, I looked at the sky and there were great white cumulus clouds visible. Bright clouds at night, backlit by the moon, have always kind of thrilled me. They seem so surreal and yet make you feel very much like you are part of a planet, part of a universe. Not just in a random city. Then I did something I do sometimes when maybe I feel a little lost or need to remind myself of exactly where I am in my life. I sort of clear away the junk and do a quick metaphysical inventory. Consciousness that this is a planet, I whisper to myself, and of the sky and the clouds. Consciousness of my mother, who loved clouds and who died a year ago tomorrow. Consciousness that I'm lucky to be here. Consciousness that I got myself here. Consciousness that I'm thankful.
I think that's an amazing place to end it.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for the conversation.
I'm Michelle Sullivan, and you're listening to Swan Feather Radio.